It is time to begin the second lecture of these Norton lectures with Dr. Gene Elshtain. Dr. Elshtain is one of the most distinguished and best-known public intellectuals in America today. And since not all of you were here for the first lecture, I'm going to go ahead and repeat some of her distinguishing awards and accomplishments for you. Dr. Elshtain is the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the University of Chicago Divinity School. She is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She's a Guggenheim Fellow. She holds the McGuire Chair of Ethics at the Library of Congress. She's a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, and we could go on and on in this regard. She's a prolific author, having written over a dozen books, edited many others, written hundreds of scholarly essays and articles. In addition, she frequently lectures in the United States and abroad on themes of democracy, ethical dilemmas, religion and politics, and international relations. Before her current post at the University of Chicago, she served on the faculty of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and at Vanderbilt University. She has also held the Levy Chair in the Foundations of American Freedom at Georgetown University. Her most recent book is Sovereignty, God, State, and Self, which is from her Gifford Lectures from the University of Edinburgh. In addition, Professor Elshtain is married and is the mother of 5 children, including 1 adopted grandchild, and she has 4 grandchildren. Won't you welcome Dr. Elshtain?
I feel as if I'm in that film Groundhog Day, you know, waking up and it's the same thing over, but the lecture is different, so it won't be an exact repetition. Well, thank you, those of you who stayed on for this, and some of you who've come specifically for this second lecture. And as I've already been up here before, I won't do any preliminary stuff, but we'll start right in. In December of 2002, I was invited to deliver a sermon at the St. Charles Baptist Church in New Orleans. This is an old and venerable church that has played an important role in the history of that great city. On that occasion, I talked about the question of plenty and whether we have lost a concept of what counts as enough. What does it mean to have enough? Now, let me share with you a bit of what I said on that occasion, for it will help lead us into our topic. One that requires that we make certain distinctions that we are perhaps unused to making because we have slothfully, I always like to pull one of the 7 deadly sins into the discussion if I can. That's such a great word, sloth. We don't use it much. Slothfully acquiesced in certain cultural assumptions that should instead be challenged, particularly by Christians. The Lord came that we might have life and might have it more abundantly. But having more abundantly is not the same as the notion that we have a lot, but we want more, so we acquire more. There have always been those around with more yet, so we strive and strive, like Fitzgerald's Jay Gatsby, but never quite arrive at the green light beckoning at the end of Daisy's dock. We have lost a concept of enough. By contrast, having life more abundantly relies on our capacity to ask questions about goods and the good, to reflect on what we in fact deprive ourselves of in our quest for more and more and yet more. So the initial point I am putting into play here is that there are vital distinctions we no longer make between abundance and plenty in the material sense. Caught up in the latter, we may abandon or lose the former, and we do so at our peril. So I begin with that because, again, there are some critical distinctions that I argue we're in danger of losing. One is, what does it mean to have life more abundantly, and what does it mean to have more and more and more? So I want to put another critical distinction into play for the purpose of this lecture. So let's turn to health and disease. We all want good health. It is one of life's great blessings. And we all fear disease, especially certain diseases. The dread word cancer, for example. When I was a child, one of those dreaded words was polio or infantile paralysis. And that word or those words became a reality for my family and for me. And the reality was every bit as dreadful as the word. Unsurprisingly, we rejoiced when the polio vaccine came into use, although it was too late to be of any direct benefit to me. Children now would be spared. Health would triumph over disease. Throughout my lifetime, the bar has been raised higher and higher and higher yet on what counts as health, what counts as illness or disease. We have come so far, we have done so much. How many times have we heard the word conquer? We're going to conquer this illness, or we speak of a war against cancer. The conquest of germs, the triumph over this or that. Once we conquered polio, we moved on to conquer something else. And we're distressed if the war seems to go on and on against a disease like cancer. But we issue reports from the battlefront on a regular basis about just how near might be a victory. Now, I don't want anyone to get me wrong. Making scientific headway against illnesses that lead to terrible human suffering is a great achievement. God gave us minds to use. We're also gifted with free will. And alas, as you know, our wills turned against God in that fateful moment in the garden. So Holy Scripture tells us, and we fell. So forever after, our wills were flawed and our minds could not aspire to moral perfection. Now, why mention the fall in the same breath as I talk about the greatness and inescapability of medical and scientific advance? I do so because we forget on a daily basis that we are fallen. Indeed, many are now determined to conquer finitude itself, as I mentioned in the previous lecture. Mortality has become a kind of illness. There is talk of immortalization, of creating a world in which my DNA goes on forever, as if that means that I do somehow, and death is no more. When I suggested to one enthusiast and a believer that the quest for immortalization in the name of health and wellness did not comport with Christian belief, he was genuinely puzzled. When the Lord told us he came that we might have life and have it more abundantly, did that not mean that we, if we could devise a way to live forever, we should, and in perfect health too? At a wellness clinic I attended, one speaker lectured us about the new ideal of human life that pertains in the wellness movement. And it holds that, rather than experiencing any sense of the decline of our powers, we now aspire to stay completely fit, hale and hearty, and then one day we just up and die. But we haven't been a burden to ourselves or anyone else up to that point. We haven't lingered in an unseemly fashion, caught in illness and decrepitude and dependency. Weakness is a horror in this scenario, helplessness something akin to an affront. As in the scenarios of plenty, the new concepts of health assume that we cannot have enough. We can always grow fitter, and we should. Only moral slackers devote themselves to other things when, with their spare time, they could be lifting weights or running or doing aerobic dance. A form of moral censure descends on those who are unfit, unwell, unhealthy. They likely brought it on themselves and they should shape up immediately. Now again, don't get me wrong. As God's creatures, we are obliged to respect our bodies and to care for them. We should not treat the great gift of life recklessly. We should not harm our bodies needlessly. But that doesn't seem to me to be what's at stake here. What is at stake is a quest for control. Nature, the creator, set things up rather badly. This seems to be an underlying assumption. We are trapped in finitude. We are not only natals, but we are mortals, and we need to do something about that. In the meantime, we must keep as much control as possible. Now, I've written and spoken previously of the quest for control and the ways in which we are starting to sort people out by genetic criteria. In our demand for bodily perfection, for a standard of health that weeds out the unfit, we are moving into a realm, as I suggested in the previous lecture, of eugenics under this new name of positive genetic enhancement. Again, the assumption is the body we inhabit is imperfect, it's unhealthy in some fundamental sense, it's subject to the vagaries of illness and aging. The future perfect body will be our own gleaming fabrication, and we measure this body against a standard of health and perfection that promises an endless supply of new body parts via stem cell research. And some have even suggested that clonees, not being fully human, might be kept alive in order that their organs could be harvested to replace the worn-out organs of real persons. Now, there is an irony in all this, is there not? And I pointed it out in the previous lecture. Let me say it again. Even as we as a culture have all become or are enjoined to become what is routinely called health nuts, we also prize ourselves on our enlightened attitude toward persons with disabilities and the correct terminology of the time, persons who cannot be fit into our standard of fitness. We don't want to deny anybody his or her rights or access to what everyone else has. So even as we zoom along in our quest for perfect health, we make provisions for those who, by definition, can never attain such a standard. But just how secure is this concern, and how sturdy are these provisions? Now consider the following, and I'm going to put it in the form of a strong thesis that I articulated previously, and I want to develop it further here. Liberal society, our own, cannot sustain equal regard for persons with disabilities over the long run, especially if these disabilities are mental. It cannot do this because our governing presuppositions push so strongly in the direction of privileging choice as the primary good in human life. Celebrating choice as the apogee of human aspiration, we now combine choice with modern technologies of reproductive and genetic engineering. And these technologies and our dominant philosophy dictate that it would be far better if persons who are incapable of choosing on this model, if they were not to appear among us in the first place. We would be better off as a culture if such persons were not born. Our standard of health suggests as much. So we strive through genetic engineering and abortion to ensure that such persons are not born. Who would want to be born unfit anyway, we say, in effect. And so strong is the prejudice this direction that we simply assume that hypothetical unborn children with disabilities would, if they could, choose not to be born. For those who would choose to be born with a limitation. Within our dominant framework, persons with handicaps who are among us should be given access. It's one of our buzzwords, as I've observed, and they should not be discriminated against unjustly. We've moved beyond the years of hiding such people away. But the fact that such human beings have rights if they live in our midst does nothing to mitigate the urgent cultural norms that measure progress by how successful we have been at lowering the incidence of births of the disabled. So despite all our hoopla about difference, if the difference stand before us in broken bodies and with broken minds, that is a difference our standards of wellness tells us we should do something to eliminate. Now the medical profession, the wider culture, currently urges the aborting of such human beings. And in our brave new world in which we will all be born well and only grow weller, if I may coin a neologism here, this admittedly clumsy method can be replaced by a system of positive eugenics, as it is called. Now, one leading bioethicist describes the profoundly retarded and the comatose as, quote, human non-persons. These are beings with membership in the human species, but they have no standing in the, quote, secular moral community, right? No standing in the secular moral community. Our standard of health precludes this full standing. Now, surely if this attitude comes to prevail on a general scale, the barriers to the elimination of such persons will slowly and inexorably wither away. If we go the direction of Holland and approve, mentioned it previously, physician-assisted or medicalized euthanasia, such human non-persons could be removed from among us after birth, as they are now eliminated before birth via selective abortion. Now, to be sure, many of those who say that the radically unwell lack full moral standing do not necessarily think it's a good idea to deprive them of life. Given our religious traditions, public barriers to the killings of persons with severe disabilities remain. But such barriers are under continuous pressure to weaken, to succumb to the demands of secular morality, with its rising standard of what counts as healthy, hence what constitutes a normative ideal of what it means to be a person. So you can be a member of the human species and not be a person in this view. So standards of health and illness are not just neutral diagnoses of conditions on objective medical criteria. Such standards take on a potent normative dimension and shape, perhaps, and they shape, perhaps subtly, the contours of our assessment of what is a good life, what is a healthy life, what is a life worth living. And if I am correct in this, and we keep moving in our current cultural direction, it seems likely that over time, the remaining inhibitions and prohibitions embedded deeply in our moral intuitions as these have been shaped by Judaism and Christianity will slowly give way. Now, ethicist Hans Reinder, as I quoted him in the previous lecture, has shown that, I'm quoting, people with mental disabilities, and I would extend this to cover all marked disabilities. People with mental disability and their families have reasons to be worried about their future in liberal society. I'm still quoting. The rapid proliferation of genetic testing may have discriminatory effects because it brings the birth of a disabled child within the focus of reproductive choice, which makes their parents answerable to the charges of irresponsible behavior. End of quote. Now, I told you in the previous lecture that a mother of a Down syndrome child had written me responding to a column I had written, and I want to stress the point she made in that letter one more time for you. And that was, she feared, and she articulated this, that the time was rapidly approaching when parents who chose to bring an unhealthy child into the world, for mental disability is by definition a sign of unwellness, when they could have aborted that child and spared themselves and society and the child himself or herself, who would rather not have been born if given a choice, that they would be labeled irresponsible and therefore wholly culpable. That is, why should we, the healthy, support those who have chosen irresponsibly in favor of a condition we regard as unhealthy in the deepest, one might even say, ontological sense? Now, I want to assure you that none of what I have been saying is the stuff of science fiction. It is the texture of our ethical lives at this moment. The urgency to eliminate flaws is palpable. Our understanding of humanity narrows as our normative ideal of what counts as a healthy person free from illness expands. Accepting the unwell and those with disabilities becomes for us an ever more arduous task. And this leads me to the unhappy conclusion that a liberal culture, which is a good culture in so many ways, is not in a strong position to sustain support for the unwell, particularly if it takes the form of prolonged illness or of disability. Our quest for control and prevention pushes us toward the elimination of certain conditions, and that in turn may even invite at some terrible future moment elimination of persons on the grounds that although they may belong to the human species, they are not full-fledged members of the secular moral community, as the ethicist I quoted told us. Now, let me go to biblical teaching for a moment under the rubric of healing and curing, if there's a difference. Now, some of you may be wondering about what I have written in light of or said today, in light of Jesus's healing mission. Did Jesus himself not eliminate conditions? Did he not make the lame to walk, the blind to see? Was he not in his own way working to eliminate flaws and imperfections? Now, I am not a biblical exegete. I'm not a trained theologian, and I probably have something really wrong here, and I'm sure that the theologians and biblical exegetes will tell me if that's true, but let me just blunder along with what I've got and see if it helps us in any way. Jesus helps us to think about a critical distinction that we systematically eliminate or elide altogether nowadays, and I refer to this the distinction between what it means to cure and what it means to heal. Now let's remind ourselves of a few of these scriptural moments, all drawn from the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew 8, 5 to 17 recounts the story of Jesus healing a paralyzed servant who is in terrible distress. When the centurion in Capernaum tells the Lord of his servant in distress, Jesus says, "I will come and heal him." The centurion tells Jesus that he is not worthy for the Lord to enter under his roof. "Only say the word and my servant will be healed." When Jesus hears the centurion's tale of his worldly power, "I am a man of authority with soldiers under me," but his weakness, confronted with the paralysis of his servant, and this leads the centurion to a conviction of his own unworthiness, Jesus says to him that he has not even in Israel found such faith. He sends the man forth with these words, "Be it done for you as you have believed." And we are told the servant was healed at that very moment. Hard upon this story comes one about Peter's mother-in-law lying sick with fever. Jesus touches her and she is healed. Then the same evening, many who were possessed with demons were brought to him. Matthew tells us he cast out the evil spirits with a word and healed those who were sick. The healing mission continues with a famous story in Matthew 9 of the ruler who comes to Jesus telling him that his daughter has died. He pleads with Jesus to come with him and to lay his hand on her, for then she will live. Following the ruler, Jesus is in turn followed by a woman who has suffered from a hemorrhage for 12 years. She touches the fringe of Jesus' garment, believing that if she can but touch the garment, she will be made well. And Jesus turns, sees her, and tells her to take heart, for your faith has made you well. Upon arriving at the ruler's house, Jesus tells the grieving to depart, for the girl is only sleeping. The crowd laughs, but the girl rises when Jesus takes her by the hand. And throughout the district, the word spreads. Blind men follow him. It is their expression of belief prior to the Lord's touch that is essential to their healing. Matthew 15 tells another story of demonic possession. We learn of the plea of a Canaanite woman who begs Jesus to have mercy on her, for my daughter is severely possessed by a demon. The disciples want to send her away. We get the impression that her pleading is making of her a nuisance. And Jesus initially says that he has been sent but to the lost sheep of Israel, but the woman's faith touches him. "Great is your faith," he proclaims, and her daughter is healed. Well, what are we to make of all of this? Should contemporary Christians be a bit embarrassed because the healing miracles seem fantastic? Some even find the healing miracles problematic because they say the story suggests that something is wrong with being lame or blind or demon-possessed, and that it is certainly wrong to depict mental illness, for that is how we translate demonic possession nowadays. It's a form of mental illness. Our contemporary prejudices get in the way of our understanding. Now, surely, however, it seems to me that the stories help us to reflect on the distinction between a cure in the modern medical sense and healing in the biblical sense. The removal of bodily symptoms signified an inward shift, if you will, from distress and derangement to healing. Your faith has made you well, has made you whole. Remember that Jesus elsewhere chides those of little faith who require external signs for everything, those who demand evidence, and all of us at one time or the other are such persons. The key to authentic healing, the stories tell us, is faith. Healing can occur in the absence of a cure, and that is precisely the distinction that eludes us or stuns us so much we don't know what to make of it. Something I observed all those years ago when I spent months in the Children's Hospital in Denver, Colorado, in a ward crammed with polio kids, of whom I was one, that some children were healed without being cured. Others at times, those who were better off than many of the rest of us, were neither healed nor cured. These children grew silent and depressed. They retreated into helpless babyhood. They became angry and anxious. Yet others approached their illness with sadness. What child could not but be sad at the loss of childhood in a profound sense, but also with calm and determination? What made the difference? Obviously, I cannot explore this question as an empirical matter. Why did this child retreat into emotional isolation, or that child retain his or her ability to reach out to others and to participate in fellowship? But I can affirm that in the absence of a cure, there can be healing. It is this recognition we are in danger of losing. We act as if the absence of a cure is an unnecessary irritation in minor cases and a violent affront in other cases. Studies of the worlds of dying children who know they're dying, suggest that the children who were healed before dying of their illnesses were those whose families had been honest with them, loved them, let go of anger, and kept the family circle alive until it was cruelly broken by death. The children who were neither cured nor healed were being protected by frightened parents and frustrated doctors who believed the children shouldn't be told what was going on. Parents and doctors who were so angry and frightened, they thought primarily about themselves and not about the child. When we are consumed by our own emotions, we cannot faithfully tend to and offer ourselves to others. There is a powerful need of healing, and because we seek exclusively a cure, healing may elude us. In 1944, C.S. Lewis published a prescient book called The Abolition of Man. Lewis lamented certain developments in education that focused more on our own subjective sentiments than on authentic human value and the human engagement with the world. The approach he criticized was incurably present-minded, believing that the past was fit only for overcoming. We lose much of the strength of tradition as a result, and we move into a world of false sentiments, he tells us. And we will pay a heavy price for this dereliction, Lewis predicted, for a famished nature will be avenged, and a hard heart is no infallible protection against a soft head. Now, part and parcel of the abolition of man was our alleged conquest of nature. Lewis worried about selective breeding. He had a sense of what was going on in Germany and the terrible implications of eugenics. He worried about the pretension that applied psychology would lead us to believe we had full control over ourselves, and that we had such full control, over ourselves, that we could not only dominate ourselves, but we had the acumen, the knowledge necessary for dominating over others. Now, that seems far more manageable than striving to seeking what is good. Control is easier than trying to understand what is good. Lewis worried that we would no longer be able to distinguish what is corrupt and degenerate, because these imply a doctrine of value, and these doctrines would have become meaningless over time. We couldn't defend them any longer. So our inability to distinguish healing from cure, our refusal to reflect critically on the exponential leap in our standards of what counts as health or wellness and the dark underside of these developments, all attest to what Lewis called the abolition of man. And that lurks throughout in my discussion. What is our understanding of the human person? In what does our dignity consist? Who is and who is not within the boundary of full moral concern? Now, let me share with you, if you will indulge me, something I wrote back in 1992 that speaks to this issue, and it actually appears as an afterword in my most recent book. It's very brief. It's a short reflection. And it has to do with how we think about those with who are profoundly disabled. And I thought this, it would be a good point on which to conclude this second lecture. With these questions in mind, what is our understanding of the dignity of the human person? Who is and who is not within the boundary of full moral concern? And how we respond to that in our own lives. This is written in 1992. This is a story of empty pockets. During a recent trip to Rome, I enjoyed an evening in the company of a group that included a young Jesuit who had spent a year in El Salvador and was due to return there soon. At one point over the course of the evening's discussion, Father Michael described the time that he had spent at one of the L'Arche communities, that's L'ARCHE, L'Arche communities, founded by a Canadian named Jean Vanier. L'Arche began in 1964 when Vanier bought a home in rural France and invited two adults with mental retardation to live there with him. Some 60 L'Arche communities now exist worldwide. The guiding spirit behind L'Arche differs dramatically from the therapeutic paternalism that often structures relationships between the normal and the mentally handicapped. L'Arche is a community dedicated to the unlikely proposition that the more able should not do things to or for the less able, but should instead live with them in covenant. Writes Vanier, handicapped people are teachers of the strong. With their tremendous qualities of heart and lives of faith and love, the handicapped give testimony to the truth that the privileged place for meeting with God is in our vulnerability and our weakness. I thought of Vanier's words as I listened to Father Michael tell a story of empty pockets. At L'Arche, Michael helped to dress and clean a profoundly handicapped young man. And one day it struck him that this young man went out of his room and into the world and through his life every day with empty pockets. Father Michael thought of how odd it was. No change, no wallet, no keys, another guest and I exclaimed simultaneously, showing no doubt both our automotive and professional preoccupations. Need keys to that car. In my own case, domestic concerns also helped to account for my outbursts concerning keys, keys to one's home being central to one's sense of self and place. The real problem, Father Michael decided, was not with his handicapped brother, but as he put it, with me and my ideas of how he felt. As Father Michael said these words, he put his hand over his heart, and I mused and remarked on how the heart's understanding of humanity is often much more generous and expansive than definitions that rely on measures of intelligence or productive capability. This led those at the table to talk about the growing eugenics enthusiasm. This is back in 92, with its technocratization of birth and its tacit conviction that the world would be better off if they, the handicapped with their empty pockets, were no longer to appear among us. It is important to note that the urge to eliminate those handicapped biogenetically is a view often born of compassion. We feel really sorry for them. But this compassion quickly turns perverse because it is a free-floating, untethered sentimentalization devoid of content, context, and concrete experience and engagement with those with empty pockets. As I was driven back to my room near the Santa Maria Maggiore on that becalmed, warm Roman night, I felt a spreading sorrow which has remained with me, for I am convinced that our reigning metaphors of success and productivity, of what counts as definitive of the human, will more and more leave our fellow human beings with their empty pockets in the shadows, eclipsed, outside the circle of concern. And here the unbearable lightness of a certain sort of triumphalist and narrow secularism, I don't know what else to call it, can be seen as exacting a terrific toll in its heady leaps, always forward, always upward, pockets full of keys, inexorably extending and deepening not our awe and our humility, but our drive for sovereign control. And I remembered one of Vanier's warnings. One of the dangers in our world, he writes, is wanting to do big things, heroic things. But we are called to do things lovingly, to work to create community. Well, you don't have to be, you don't have to have your pockets full to be a citizen of that polity. So thank you very much for your attention for this second lecture. And I'll take some questions, and I'll see some of you, I hope, tomorrow. Thank you.
So we have two microphones, so please come forward and ask your questions. Go ahead, brother.
You touched on earlier germline cell therapy.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, you touched on how just further on down the line it could create moral problems, but do you see anything ontologically immoral with it, given the biblical mandate to subdue creation and seeing germline cell therapy as a subjugation of kind of a holistically human being?
Well, I think that it's that certainly what one is doing when one moves that direction is to presume that manipulation or alteration of something as fundamental as the elements that make up a human life, genetically speaking, that is the kind of tinkering that we can undertake and guarantee a certain kind of beneficent outcome that would presumably locate us or relocate us ontologically, so to speak, in a somewhat different place. By that I mean, it doesn't change the ground of being in a fundamental way and so on, but it would mean that how we understand the human and what might await us down the road and the sorts of things that we might be subject to, that will alter over time given these manipulations. But you'll notice that each one of these efforts is always accompanied by a glowing best-case scenario of what the outcome will be. We will not fundamentally alter what is human. We will still be recognizably human, although there are some transhumanists who want to alter what's human, as you may know, and change us into something else. But the calmer voices say, no, it won't be that. It's just that we'll be human, but more so. We'll be better at being human somehow without these conditions. Well, at one point you cross a line where what you're doing is not simply trying to prevent harms. The physician's mandate, do no harm, first of all. When you've moved well beyond that to something else, to some other something, where you really see yourself as a kind of substitute creator, you are a godlike being, bringing something into being in the way in which God did, but he messed it up and we're going to do a better job. And there are some who've actually said this, who said, well, God wants us to, we're created in God's image, and he must want us to be like him. So, ergo, it follows that I can do this with nary a backward glance. Your question is maybe too complicated for me on the ontological part of it. I have to think about some of those issues. But certainly the pridefulness involved in assuming that we can perfect that which is now imperfect and that we can do so in a way that guarantees a beneficent outcome is really an extraordinary claim, it seems to me. For example, when there's talk of what we could do to make sure that Down syndrome infants are no longer born. And it wouldn't take a lot. We just have to do a little tweaking here or there. But because Down syndrome infants occur with astonishing regularity, you know, out of so many births, I don't think we have any idea of what all is going on in the larger scheme of things, of what all this particular condition, what else it may be linked to. As you know, when you're, I'm not a geneticist, but when you're dealing with cells, it's not just one cell here. And you can, you know, you've got cells on alleles, you know, you've got bunches of them all together. It's a big complicated structure. And you don't know what you're gonna do if you mess with one of them, what that's gonna do to the others. So in the absence of that, it would seem that we would be well advised to move very cautiously and very slowly. But let me just give you, since you asked that question, I didn't do it in the interest of time in my first lecture, just the way in which some of the wilder proponents of altering us ontologically, how they define their, understand their enterprise. This is the president of the Extropian Institute, which is one of the leading transhumanist think tanks. And this is what he says about transhumanism. That's where we're going. Get away with this simple human stuff. Transhumanism is a commitment to overcoming human limits in all their forms, including extending lifespan, augmenting intelligence, perpetually increasing knowledge, achieving complete control over our personalities and identities, and gaining the ability to even leave the planet. Transhumanists seek to achieve these goals by reason, science, and technology. And then here's another one, also involved with transhumanism. As humans redesign themselves after their own values, new forms of humanity will develop. Many of these post-humans will diverge radically from us. Some humans will likely develop themselves into something quite like Greek gods, long-lived, possibly immortal, physically and mentally almost perfect humans. Others may develop far more radically, perhaps into digital life forms swimming through the information networks, or transcendental superminds among the moons of Jupiter. Now, you know, these folks aren't locked up. I mean, this is, you know, you say, whoa, serious delusion here. I mean, they're out there working every day and really do see themselves as bringing about this transhumanist future. So on the farther end of this, you've got those who want to go beyond the human altogether. And then you have those who want to do some pretty radical modification. And then you have those who are far more modest and want to try to, you know, maybe eliminate this or do something about that. And you're not going to get most of the grandiose claims from them. They're not going to come from that middle group or the way out people. And those folks for sure want to alter the ontological status and condition of human beings. That's for sure. The others in that first group, one can certainly understand why they want to do what they're doing, but I think that they resolutely refuse to look at possible negative consequences. And that's such a typically American thing. You know, we always want to look at the best possible consequences of social change and not look at what Reinhold Niebuhr called the ironies of American history and how, you know, certain things that we thought were going to be salutary turned out to have less than beneficial consequences, which again suggests humility in how we go forward. But Americans are not, unfortunately, well known for their humility either. So I'm afraid, well, that's enough. I'll stop there. It's a very interesting question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. One of the things that I'm struggling to bring together in my mind is this idea of community.
Yes.
That I think both within the church walls and outside in the public square.
Right.
It's kind of like a buzzword, community. But then you also have diversity.
Yeah.
And so if there's this desire to bring this eradication of any health or physical abnormalities, how can we fully embrace complete community and fully embrace complete diversity if we're willing to negate a second tier of community that's not normative for, I guess you'd say, the majority?
Yeah. Well,
could you give some reflections on that?
Sure. I mean, in a way, I think the person that I quoted about they're human, but they're not full persons in the secular moral community, was suggesting something like, you know, we have a secular moral community, which is where most of us want to be, these folks just do not have full standing in that secular moral community. And then, I think he didn't state this, but I suspect what he had as a partial contrast model was, we have these other communities, probably think partial communities, sectarian communities, and so forth. We have these religious groups and so on where these folks are fully accepted as members of the community, of their community, but obviously those communities are less enlightened, you know, less committed to progress, less fully informed and so forth than we are in the secular moral community. And this is a community that counts, you know, because we're going to determine things like, we'll make the determination about medical treatment, medical benefits, about all other questions having to do with the well-being of persons across the board. So, you know, they can be welcomed perhaps within a particular church and partake of communion and all the rest. But that doesn't mean they're full persons in our view. So I think there's that going on, where you say you've got perhaps diversity is in different types of communities with different standards, but we know that the secular moral community is going to trump. It's the dominant one, and it's the one that must prevail because we are a secular state and their implication is a secular society, finally. I think that's wrong about the United States. We're a secular state, but we're by no means a fully secularized society. But that's another discussion. So the paradox of their project, if I may say so, is that one at the same time, you find celebrations of diversity, but you have this strong push towards a kind of homogenization of people. So you get a type of person, more likely to get a certain guaranteed type of person, even as you're celebrating diversity, but doing it by sort of counting diversity as race issues or sexual identity issues and so on, rather than no one puts, you know, paraplegics in there is a type of diversity, or people with Alzheimer's is a type of diversity, and so forth. So you eliminate all of that, then you have this diversity, but everybody is similarly fit, you know, and able-bodied, and so on and so forth, sort of marching forward, and then you call that diversity, and you call that the secular moral community. But a real human community, as you know, is by definition, St. Augustine taught us, is plural, is pluralist. There are different types of people in the world. You know, if you read Augustine's City of God, he has this very capacious definition of who belongs who are the sons of Adam. You know, and he recounts some stories told by Pliny the Elder the stories that travelers came back with. He said, we're not obliged to believe in these people. I don't know if such things exist or not, but if they do, they're human too, and they were, because they have a way to communicate. They seem to be rational, and they're creatures like folks with human bodies but dogs' heads. Stories told about them, and they barked with one another, but they had a communication system. Stories about people. It's a wonderful, wonderful passage in the City of God. People with who do talk to one another, but they're sort of planted in the ground and have a big foot going over like a fan to shield them from the hot sun. You know, well, who are these? So he just keeps expanding the definition. Okay, they're part of the sons of Adam too, and has this really capacious definition about who belongs. And again, the criteria are they live in some kind of community and they have some way to communicate with one another. Not privileging, you know, the type of body you're in, not privileging, you know, whether you're brilliant or not brilliant and so forth. So what we've seen over time in the West, certainly, is the narrowing of that definition of what counts as fully human, and a privileging over time of our capacity to engage in certain complex mental ratiocinations on the level of Which is why we worry so much, or philosophers have worried so much, about those that they sort of gently called idiots, imbeciles, and morons. You know, what do you do with them? Can they sign the social contract? You know, I'm a trained political theorist. What do you do with them? Can they be part of the secular moral community or not? And there was great ambivalence about that. What do you do with them? You know, they can't function the way you're supposed to function. So these folks are always falling by the wayside. You know, they're not fully conscious, they're not fully this, they're not fully that. So I think this is an extension of that, the stuff I've been talking about. Deep, deep strands in the Western tradition. If you went back to, you know, some of the earlier understandings of the Christian community, you know, you would find a far more generous understanding of who belongs in the human community. And it's a far more diverse community as a result. So we talk a lot about diversity, but we're narrowing it. We're narrowing our definition of what it means to be human. And we cannot abide, as I said, some differences. We can't abide them. We don't want to see them.
Thank you for coming.
Sure.
Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
As I, my limited understanding of these things, as I think about them, it seems like as we think about eugenics and you're talking about transhumanism and just becoming better humans, it seems to me that that's all flowing out of evolutionary thought.
But you
mentioned in your first lecture that the relationship between science and society is a lot more complicated than we think. So I'm assuming that me thinking that it's more complicated than that. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned evolutionary thought. What's interesting is that the transhumanist folks that I noted are even quite impatient with evolutionary thought. They believe that it's too limited in its aspirations as to what we might become, and that evolution takes too long, and that human beings have to find ways to speed this process along. So they do, you know, if you ask them what kind of, if they have a philosophy, it's certainly materialism of a certain sort. You know, we're entities of some kind that can reproduce ourselves and so forth. But then they really do move away, it seems to me, from that sort of grounding. Evolutionary theory at least realizes human beings are in the world in bodies and reproduce in an embodied way and so forth. They move very rapidly away from that into these realms of a kind of existence on the level of consciousness with the body, you know, taking all kinds of fantastic forms, or no body at all, but somehow you still exist, you know, like this one fellow said, swimming through information networks and so forth. So you rapidly sort of abstract from the body. So there's a fascination with a certain extraordinarily abstract, disembodied way of being in the world. And I think, again, one of the things that's such an offense to these folks, represents an offense, people with physical disabilities and so forth remind us always about bodies and about the frailty of the body and what might happen to the body and so on. And that's really an affront, and they don't want to see it. So the only way they can think about that is either not to think about it at all, just ignore the issue, or assume that over time we'll find a way to weed these people out through selective birth regimes and so forth, or you know, we'll find ways to turn them into something else. So they won't. Their embodiment will no longer affront us and frighten us. I mean, you've probably had the experience. I certainly have. I remember not too long ago, I think it was last Christmas, was with my family. We were in Chicago and had gone to a store, and there was a little restaurant in the store. We were sitting at this restaurant, and there was a young man who had no arms, with his caregiver, who was also a friend. I mean, they were chatting animatedly, and the friend went to get the young man some food, and he had to bend over like this to eat his food. Had to bend down, and people were absolutely horrified. You could see people looking over and quickly averting their gaze. I saw one mother with her child sort of shielding the child from this awful sight and sort of, you know, steering the child another direction. It said, oh, this is so gross, you know, as if the fellow should not be eating in public. This is too much of an affront. So why is that? I think it's because it really taps some of our very deep fears about the vulnerability of the body. And Christianity should help us deal, as Christians, we should be able to deal with that. We should be able to think about that and find a more generous way to approach our fellow human beings. So, well, thank you all very much. I'll see some of you tomorrow, I hope. Did you have a question?
Yes.
Oh, well, come forward. Sorry, I didn't mean, you were lurking back there. You should have come forward more. I'm sorry, we're not done yet. Okay.
Fellow Chicago native, it's nice to meet somebody else down here. Everybody's from Alabama and Georgia around here. question about the Special Olympics. You noted
sure.
earlier that we've moved from hiding them away
yeah.
to really celebrating
yeah.
Those with handicaps. Does that actually work against the goal by causing us to view them as this other
yeah.
set still? And if so, it's easy to affirm the personhood of folks who are within the walls of the church. How do we as Christians participate
yeah, yeah.
in that outside of
yeah.
the walls of the church?
Yeah. Well, two questions on the Special Olympics. I think on the whole, it's been a good thing because it shows that that people with disabilities have many of the same aspirations as other people. They want to participate. They want to run. They want to, you know, they want to do stuff. They want to use their bodies as best they can in certain ways. This is an issue that's debated in the disability community. Which is a community I'm sort of touched on a little bit. There are very interesting debates going on all the time. Within the broadly construed disability community on, you know, how best to deal with all these things. And there are profound disagreements. And some don't like things like Special Olympics. But I think on the whole, the view is that it's brought, you know, people are out in the open. They can see them struggling to achieve. They see how happy they are, you know, that they can do something and that this is a good thing altogether, finally. On your other question about affirming people in community, that it's easy when you're in the midst of, you know, of church on Sunday, but harder on the outside. The only way that I can think of right off the top of my head, unless you're going to go into a vocation that involves yourself with such persons on a daily basis, is to, in, you know, any situation in which you find yourself, you know, to be aware of the way in which most people will recoil, you know, especially from certain forms of disability and disfiguration, especially, and make sure that you do that, do not do that, and that you treat others in a non-paternalistic way, because you know there are two possibilities. One is that people with disabilities find. One is folks just, you know, look the other way, and the other is that they come over and they want to be helpful, but in a very paternalistic way, you know, like you can't do things for yourself, and kind of patting themselves on the back, you know, that they want to help. I think Christians know how to help in a way that's not paternalistic, because you're seeing before you, you know, a human being who is also created in God's image and also has moral worth. And that makes you on some level equal. So you don't have to condescend at all. And I think it's the nature of those encounters. It doesn't sound like a lot, but as Vanier says at the end, when I quoted him, you know, to do little things lovingly and to work to create community, those little things, we can't calculate the full consequences of those little things, but I'm convinced that they do add up, and I'm convinced that they do make a difference over time. Because think of other people watching you, you know, seeing how you engage and so on. I mean, the things radiate out from these encounters. So as I said, if it's not your vocation, there's still lots of things you can do. And obviously you could, even if, again, it's not your full-time job, there are always groups that are just yearning to get volunteers to help them, you know, with their activities in the community. And that's something you can look into, too, that's out there in the world and sometimes sponsored by the church, but it's not per se in the church. So, thanks. Okay, I think I am finished now. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I have two brief announcements before we dismiss. Number one, the third and final lecture will be tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Please be here. And also, Dr. Elstein will be signing books here in just a few minutes outside of the hall here. And if you have your voucher, you can go ahead and pick up your copy right outside and have your book signed. So we are dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you.